Looking again at the question of Fidas, the name Olaf Ashberg, owner of the Nya Banken in Stockholm, Sweden, comes into the picture. Some of his activities were described in an autobiography entitled Wandering Jew from Glassbrook Street. Olaf self-describes as a Bolshevik banker, laundered huge sums raised by financiers in Europe and America prior to being smuggled to Trotsky via Finland. That Trotsky was in the position to receive these funds in Russia was largely due to American President Woodrow Wilson. Wilson's biographer Jennings C. Wise, in his book Woodrow Wilson, Disciple of Revolution, wrote the following: "History must never forget that Woodrow Wilson, despite the efforts of the British police, made it possible for Leon Trotsky to enter Russia with an American passport." It is a reference to the fact that when Trotsky embarked from New York on March 26, 1917, heading for Russia, he and his party were arrested by British authorities at Halifax, Nova Scotia, but released when the American administration intervened with the British government. The Kaiser's German government also allowed itself to be used in the international conspiracy. Lenin and Trotsky were transported in a sealed train through Germany, also carrying hundreds of millions of counterfeit 10-ruble notes. The German general staff coordinated this venture, but the guiding genius behind it was the Kaiser's Minister of the Interior, Felix Warburg, an in-law relative of Jacob Schiff. Churchill wrote about this episode: "Lenin was sent into Russia in the same way that you might send a field containing a culture of cholera to be poured into the water supply of a great city." The German Chief of Staff General Ludendorff later said of this escapade: "By sending Lenin to Russia, our government assumed a great responsibility." After the war, an embittered Kaiser Wilhelm II gave an interview to Chicago Tribune, July 2, 1922, in which he said, "The Jews are responsible for Bolshevism in Russia and Germany too. I was far too indulgent with them during my reign, and I bitterly regret the favors I showed to prominent Jewish bankers." In his book Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, Professor Anthony Sutton quotes from Great Britain Directorate of Intelligence, a monthly review of the progress of revolutionary movements abroad. Quote, July 16, 1913, summary: "There is now definite evidence that Bolshevism is an international movement controlled by Jews. Communications are passing between the leaders in America, France, Russia and England with a view to concerted action," end of quote. For many years, one of the biggest hoaxes inflicted upon the gullible mankind was the generally believed story that the Russian Revolution of 1917 was an uprising of the Russian people under the brilliant leadership of Lenin and Trotsky, whereas in fact it was an international coup resulting in the enslavement of the population. The so-called Russian Revolution was manipulated by so-called Jews and the descendants of the converted Mongolian Khazars. These neo-Khazars are known as Polish or Russian Jews, and in Hebrew as Ashkenazim, the Hebrew word for Germany. By the late 1800s, significant numbers of Ashkenazi Jews were found in Germany, the Balkans, and eventually all over Europe. Because of their activities in Russia, they had become targets of persecution by the Tsars. They got their revenge when they both ordered and executed the murder of the Romanov family. On the wall of the basement where the Tsar and his family were murdered, they scrawled a parody of the Marxist Jewish poet Heinrich Heine's lines on the death of Belshazzar, which in the book of Daniel in the Old Testament portrays God's punishment for an affront to Judah. It was the Ashkenazi Jew who in large numbers migrated to the USA. They also migrated to Palestine, Central and South America. Wherever they went, they worked to implant their traditional communism, socialism. The prominent Zionist historian Morris U. Schaps, writing of the European immigrant Jew Joseph Weidemeyer, who fled to America after the unsuccessful 1848 communist upheavals in Europe, said of him, "He was the first Marxist to work and write in the United States." Dr. Abraham Jacoby is also credited by some Jewish authorities as the Zionist who brought Marxism to America. Marx, in a letter he wrote to Engels, had the following: "Jacoby is making good business. The Yankees like his serious manner." Jacobi became the first secretary of the first American Commons Club. Eventually, a stranglehold of Zionist power over successive U.S. governments was built up. The prominent Jewish writer Arthur Koestler, in his 1976 study of the Khazars, the book The 13th Tribe, pointed out that the large majority of surviving Jews in the world is of Eastern European stock, and thus perhaps mainly of the Khazar origin. And he observes that this logically makes the well-worn term anti-Semitism void of meaning. Over the years, there has been considerable ill feeling between the Ashkenazi Jew and the Sephardic Jews, descendants of the original Old Testament Jews of ancient Judea. But it is the more numerous and more forceful neo-Khazars, Ashkenazi Jews, who have seized control of world Jewish affairs, largely through the financial activities of the Rothschilds, the half-dozen banking dynasties allied with them, and of course the Rockefellers. An Ashkenazi Jew, Jack Bernstein, chairman of the Association of Pro-American Jews, lived for a while in Israel and published The Life of an American Jew in Racist Marxist Israel. He reveals that it is the Ashkenazi Communist Socialist Jews, Bolshevik Jews, he calls them also, who migrated to Israel, gained control of the Zionist movement, and have dominated the government of Israel since its beginning in 1948. According to him and many other authors, the ultimate goal of the Zionists is the one world government under the control of the Zionists and the Zionist Jewish international bankers. Communism, socialism are merely tools to help them accomplish their goal. It was in 1897 that the first Zionist Congress was held at Basel, Switzerland, where they announced that they wanted Palestine for the establishment of a Jewish state. The secret Jewish Talmudic government would have existed for thousands of years, but the Jewish Zionist historian Dr. Joseph Kastein said that the Congress at Basel was the first embodiment of a real Jewish international. How powerful this Jewish Zionist international had become at the time of the First World War can be seen from the famous Balfour Declaration incident. British ambassador in Washington had written to the British Foreign Minister Sir Edward Grey on November 2, 1917, informing him that the Jews have a strong preference for the German Emperor and there must be some bargain. This resulted in a letter being sent from British Foreign Secretary Balfour to Lord Rothschild, one of the leading figures of the British Zionist movement, according to Professor Quigley. Balfour's letter said, "His Majesty's government view would favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this object." Winston Churchill subsequently recorded that the Balfour Declaration was made to political Zionists in order that they would use their enormous influence on the side of the Western Allies at a time when the military situation was desperate. The Jewish homeland in Palestine was a prize behind America's entry into the First World War, even though President Wilson had been elected on the pledge of keeping America out of that war. Emmanuel M. Josephson, in his book The Federal Reserve Conspiracy and Rockefeller, Their Gold Corner, published in New York in 1968, Chedney Press, reveals another price paid for America's entry into that war. According to him, Rockefeller Banks, Chase National, Equitable Trust, Mechanics and Metals Bankers Trust, and Konloben Company financed Germany's launching of World War I through their joint agents, the Warburgs. Supplying Germany with the estimated $300 million involved was facilitated and largely made possible by their Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve Act assured the conspirators that any loss that might have been sustained by their treachery would be the obligation of the U.S. Treasury and of the taxpayers under the terms written into the bill by President Wilson. Through their same Federal Reserve System device, the conspirators brought pressure to bear on the Allies, who had been financed by Rothschild agent J.P. Morgan to the extent of $400 million. As soon as Winston Churchill and the British had awakened at Verdun to the realization that they could not win World War I and that they had fallen into a trap, they were then forced to yield to the demand that the Rockefeller Standard Oil Gang be given the rich oil field prices, including the enormously rich fields of British vassals Saudi Arabia and other concessions in the British sphere of influence in the Near East. In return, the conspirators and their puppet President Wilson pledged American wealth and lives to finance and fight the war for the Allies to rescue them. The deal also, of course, sealed the betrayal of the Germans. This scenario is a classic example of Mayor Rothschild's plan in 1773 in founding the Illuminati, by convincing other wealthy financiers that by working together they could control the world revolutionary movement by fomenting wars and revolutions, financing both sides, thereby driving governments on both sides into debt and dependence on them. Already we have seen that American State Department documents named Jacob Schiff of Kunlove and Company and its directors, including Felix Warburg and other Jews, as the people who started and engineered the Russian Revolution. Josephson, in his book already quoted from, refers to these people as Rockefeller's trusted banker pawns. They were also deeply concerned with what one could call the American Revolution, by which America became a conquered nation through central banking, the international bankers gaining control of the Federal Reserve System. The original Mayor Rothschild, it is claimed, coined the saying, "Give me control of a nation's money and I care not who rules it," and sent his sons abroad to do just that. On a similar mission in 1900, Paul Warburg came to America, imported by conspirators because of his extensive experience with central banking. Paul Warburg became a leading member of Kunlove & Company. He married Solomon Loeb's daughter, while his brother Felix married Jacob Schiff's daughter. On a $500,000 a year salary, Paul Warburg went around the USA selling the idea of a central banking system for the United States. In a Rockefeller home on Jekyll Island, the Federal Reserve conspiracy was plotted with people representing the interests of the Rockefellers and the interests of J.P. Morgan & Company. The bill drawn up by Paul Warburg for introduction by Senator Nelson Aldrich, whose daughter Abby was a Mrs. Rockefeller, was deliberately leaked to the press by the conspirators so as to ensure that Senator Aldrich's bill would be defeated, according to Josephus. And this was because the bill was not crooked enough to satisfy the demands of John D. Rockefeller, the first, for the control and manipulation of the money, the credit, and the wealth of the nation. They had to wait until they got their own man, Woodrow Wilson, in as president. It was December 22, 1913, that the Federal Reserve Act was passed in Congress. It is interesting that it was universally recognized that the most powerful influence behind President Wilson was Colonel Edward House, described by some as the Rockefeller, Texas agent. Professor Charles Seymour, who edited the intimate papers of Colonel House, revealed that House was the unseen guardian angel of the Federal Reserve Act, and that the original Federal Reserve Board was largely handpicked by Colonel House and, of course, included Paul Warburg. House was also closely associated with the Zionist movement. Rabbi Stephen Wise had stated, "We received warm and heartening help from Colonel House, close friend of the President. House not only made our cause the object of his very special concern, but served as liaison officer between the Wilson administration and the Zionist movement." Some years later, it was discovered that House was the author of the book Philip Drew Administrator, which described how Drew worked to establish socialism as dreamed by Karl Marx. Professor Charles Seymour also wrote, "Mr. House did not guide American state policy, but deflected it towards Zionism, the support of the world revolution, and the promotion of the world government ambition. President Woodrow Wilson's Federal Reserve Banking Act in 1913 gave control of the finances of the United States to the international bankers." In the year 1919, just 6 years after the founding of the Federal Reserve, Americans were paying interest upon a debt of $25,000 million. 26 years later, it was a debt of $270,000 million, $1,000 billion in 1982. The servicing of the debt in 1983 was expected to cost the U.S. Treasury something in the region of $100,000 million. Since the passing of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, the United States has plunged itself over $3 trillion in debt. Now the United States has a bigger national debt than the total net worth of the country. Experts have stated that we could give two Americas over to the Federal Reserve and still not be able to pay off the debt. According to a classified report prepared for the Joint Economic Committee of Congress in 1984, the Fed each year spends over $1 billion of the taxpayers' money with no guidance or direction from any elected body. Senator Barry Goldwater once said, "Most Americans have no real understanding of the operation of the international money lenders. The bankers want it that way. The accounts of the Federal Reserve System have never been audited. It operates outside the control of Congress and through its Board of Governors manipulates the credit of the United States," end of quote. With views like that, it is understandable that the establishment forces led by Rockefeller contingents did their utmost to stop Goldwater being nominated in San Francisco. When he was, the full power of the media, press, radio and TV were turned on him and destroyed his chances to be elected president of the USA. The paying of interest on federal debt increased living costs and federal taxes, while federal expenditures escalated. A voracious monster grows bigger every year. The bigger it grows, the more it takes until it all collapses as planned. By building up communist Russia, the international bankers also created for themselves another profitable monster called the arms race. Professor Quigley stated that at the end of 1957, a special studies project that the Rockefeller Brothers Fund suggested the existence of a missile gap, or inferiority in missile capacity of the United States compared to the Soviet Union. According to Quigley, this was a mistaken idea and played a chief role in the American presidential campaign of 1960, page 1090. Of course, it also ensured that the enormously profitable arms race would continue. Anthony Sutton in his Wall Street in the Bolshevik Revolution and other books demonstrated from impeccable sources, largely government files, that virtually the whole of Soviet Russia's industrial development and marine capacity, both merchant and naval, had come mainly from the USA, but also Western Europe. This build-up continued even during the Korean and Vietnam Wars. Professor Quigley in his Tragedy and Hope, 1,300-page book on the history of the background and development of international banking, has revealed how the U.S. Federal Reserve Board, controlling the Federal Reserve banks, was set up by private international bankers. So it is not a bona fide government agency. Moreover, it was set up under the subterfuge of an attack on those very bankers. As Dr. Carl Quigley was a prestigious historian who had been connected in his career with Harvard, Princeton, and the Foreign Service School, Georgetown University, it was a major contribution. Moreover, in his book, he informs his readers that he studied the international power structure for 20 years with access to papers and secret records. He had no aversion to what they were trying to do. While still in his first printing, the book suddenly ceased to be available and disappeared from every library, etc. Macmillan dropped it. Quigley himself said, "It apparently says something which powerful people don't want known." However, in recent times, it has been republished. It can't do any harm now that they are so well established. According to Professor Quigley, the power of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. Tragedy and Hope, page 324. We can surmise what sort of private hands would control all this, as on page 56 he informs his readers that in 1936, when the Bank of France was reformed, its Board of Regents, directors, was still dominated by the names of the families who had originally set it up in 1800. To these had been added a few more recent names, such as Rothschild, added in 1810, Protestants of Swiss origin, 18th century, Jews of German origin, who arrived in the 19th century. Quigley adds, in England a somewhat similar situation existed, so that even in the middle of the 20th century, The members of the Court of the Bank of England were chiefly associates to various oil merchant banking firms such as Baring Brothers, Morgan Grenfell, Lassard Brothers and others. On page 500, Quigley has mentioned Baring Brothers, L.M. Rothschild, J. Henry Schroeder, Morgan Grenfell, Ambrose and Lassard Brothers, as merchant bankers who, quote, in the period of financial capitalism had a dominant position with the Bank of England, and strangely enough, still have retained some of this despite the nationalisation of the bank by the Labour government in 1946, end of quote. Professor Quigley noted on page 325 of Tragedy and Hope, the power of the Bank of England was recognised by qualified observers. He quotes from one, Reginald McKenna, who had been Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1915-1916 and who as Chairman of the Board of the Midland Bank told its stockholders in 1924, I'm afraid the ordinary citizen will not like to be told that the bankers can and do create money, and they who control the credit of the nation direct the policy of governments and hold in the hollow of their hands the destiny of the people. So when the most powerful banks of the most powerful nations conspire, then it is the destiny of all people in the world that they seek to control. Those most powerful banks and private hands aiming at the control of national sovereignties by developing a one world government create money. The control of the source of over 90% of all money represents enormous power. In April 1979, the Washington Post reported that whenever members of the exclusive international banking fraternity get together, they can stop the world monetary system in its tracks if they choose to do so, because there is virtually no regulation of international banking. Benjamin Strong became the first governor of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in 1914, having been the joint nominee of Morgan and Kun Lu. According to Quigley, Strong met with Montagu Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, and at once made an agreement to work in cooperation for the financial practices they both revered. Quigley claims that they were determined to use the financial power of Britain and of the United States to force all the major countries of the world to go on the gold standard, and that it would be operated through central banks free from all political control. Without interference from any government, they plan to deal with all the questions of international finance, page 326. Quigley points out that the apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations, page 324. As Professor Quigley died in 1977, the plans for this takeover must have advanced a great deal. In 1989, we had the Lower Report, the Report on Economic and Monetary Union in the European Community. A prominent name in the report invited to participate in an important committee is Mr. Lamfalussy, General Manager of the Bank for International Settlements in Basel. Furthermore, not only is a single community currency dealt with in the Lower Report, but also, quote, authority to take directly enforceable decisions, i.e. to impose constraints on national budgets, end of quote. This, of course, would be a major step towards that goal described by Quigley as nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole, page 324. The International Monetary Fund is also linked to this system and its goal. L.T. Patterson, in the March 1985 issue of his newsletter, A Monthly Lesson in Criminal Politics, pointed out that the conspirators had exposed their plan in their party magazine, Foreign Affairs, in the fall of 1984. Written by Trilateral Party functionary Richard N. Cooper under the heading A Monetary System for the Future, Cooper wrote, it is not premature to begin thinking about how we would like international monetary arrangements to evolve in the remainder of this century. With this in mind, I suggest a radical alternative scheme, the creation of a common currency for all the industrialized democracies and a common monetary policy and a joint bank of issue to determine that monetary policy. Emmanuel M. Josephson, in his book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy and Rockefellers, published by Chedney Press, New York, 1968, informs his readers on page 323 that the International Monetary Fund was organized as a subsidiary of what he calls their Federal Reserve Conspiracy at the Bretton Woods Conference in order to devise a new international currency of the type advocated by Marx and Lenin as a means of world control that will be managed by the conspirators in much the same fashion as they managed the dollar through their Federal Reserve. Their demand for a new medium of exchange created and controlled by them is nothing more than the issue by themselves through their IMF agency of a fiat unsecured currency. Josephson goes on to quote John Davenport, described by him as an honest and courageous editor of Fortune, who said that the scheme was a proposal, quote, to create a new medium of international exchange, so to speak, out of thin air. To be blunt, can liquidity be managed from the top down short of some kind of super sovereign international government, which when proposed openly and politically has again been rejected? Or are we attempting, in the matter of money, to create such sovereignty through the back door or through a trap door? End of quote. John Davenport, International Money, Fortune, New York, January 1966. Josephson goes on to state that there is ample proof that even the super-sovereign international government that the conspirators are plotting cannot give liquidity in the sense of staple purchasing power to the fiat printing press money that they issue through their Federal Reserve on the mythical gold base, and even more certainly it will not be accomplished with what they plan to issue on the basis of thin air. The scheme is certain to prove to be a snare and delusion for the lands on which it is imposed and a device to further facilitate looting and impoverishment of the world by the conspirators. One of the schemes that already has been proved to be a snare and delusion for the lands on which it was imposed and has facilitated looting and impoverishment was a scheme to recycle Arab petrodollars in loans to third world countries. Former president of Columbia University, Dr. Murray Butler, is supposed to have once said, "The world is divided into three classes of people, a very small group that makes things happen, a somewhat larger group that watches things happen, a great multitude that does not know what is happening. Among the group that watches things happen, some have realized the crucial importance of the manipulation of the oil-producing countries to sell all their oil, U.S. dollars. The plan for effective control of the world reached a vital stage in the 70s when U.S. officials, it is claimed, bribed Nigerian officials to more than double the price of the crucial light crude oil of Nigeria. OPEC was also set up. Oil producers had significantly higher prices dangled before them by the oil buyers, provided that they supported America, which meant investing their oil revenue in the big banks of the USA. The Arabs did not know that the same people controlled the prime banks and had the controlling interest in the major oil companies. It appears that a joint stock trust set up 3 years before the U.S. government declared joint trust stocks illegal in the last century. It's that entity that is the ultimate controlling factor in the oil companies and in the major multinationals. Because they had locked in deposits, the big banks were able to make huge loans to third world countries and rely on greed and mishandling to put these countries more and more into the power of these banks and the families behind them. In 1991, an interview with David Rockefeller by Brian Appleyard was published in the British Sunday Times magazine under the heading America's Last Emperor, a title that acknowledged the power of the bank that David Rockefeller headed for so many years. John D. Rockefeller had purchased the Chase Bank and his brother William bought the National City Bank of New York. The Rockefeller-Chase Bank was later merged with the Warburg's Manhattan Bank to form Chase Manhattan, the most powerful financial combine in the world at that time, according to Professor Quigley. In the published interview referred to, Appleyard wrote, "The most serious misjudgment he, David Rockefeller, is accused of making, however, was in his job as banker. From the early 70s, the Chase was one of the leaders in recycling Arab petrodollars, resulting from the huge rises in oil prices by loaning them to third world nations. It was the enthusiasm with which this policy, the ultimate global connection, was pursued that led directly to the catastrophes that began in 1982 when Mexico defaulted on her debt payments. Ever since, third world debt has been one of capitalism's most tragic and intractable crises. The article continues with Rockefeller's comment on this, which is surely a gem. He said, "It may now seem to have been foolish or careless, but basically those loans were made because the countries needed them to survive and keep alive their industry. In retrospect, it clearly went too far. But something had to be done with the money, and the existence of such vast quantities of liquidity made it tempting for the banks to relax their credit standards." End of quote. It is interesting that on November 10, 1976, the Washington Post reported that an investigation into Arab deposits in U.S. banks was blocked by senators who said the information should be provided only under a formula that was satisfactory to David Rockefeller. The vast quantities of Arab petrodollars that Chase and others had acquired were put into bank holding companies set up for the purpose of loaning money to the third world countries. The frequent rise of oil prices, especially in the 70s, was manipulated by the people who knew that the increased profits would come to their banks. Anthony Sutton, in his book about George Bush, reveals how oilman Vice President Bush personally flew to the Middle East in early 1986 to persuade the Arab countries to raise the price of oil. Bush used the argument to the Arabs that U.S. security depended on a rise in the price of crude oil. Consternation resulted in the White House and the Wall Street Journal, April 8, 1986, reported that one White House official would reference to Bush, "I don't know what he's up to." They probably said the same thing when it was discovered that he had, when President, moved an army into Saudi Arabia without congressional knowledge of its size. There is also a theory that third world countries who could not pay the interest due on their loans, not to mind the principal, were approached by the international bankers who offered to forgive and absolve their debts, provided that they eliminated their own national currencies and became dollar denominated. Subsequently, what is planned is the elimination of cash altogether, going on to a unilateral centralized credit card system. Also, the natural mineral resources of the country would be signed away in return for perpetual royalties. The third world countries that agreed to this would not let it be known. It would only be heard that they were bankrupt as regard their international debts. Eventually, the holding bank companies involved will receive the Arab petrodollars for loaning from the international bankers who wish to evade responsibility, would be left holding only the liabilities of the third world countries. And enough of the third world countries have been forgiven their debts, the holding companies declare themselves bankrupt, as was planned. The Arabs are told their money is gone, and legally the international bankers avoid paying the Arabs back their principal investment. Two birds have been killed with one stone, so to speak, and Arab leaders call America Satan. The chaos so dear to the Masonic heart that would result from the liquidation of Arab assets could trigger the financial Armageddon that the conspirators will achieve one way or another. Their remedy would be a debit card system, which they claim would wipe out tax evasion and drug trafficking, which they have organized. Sooner or later, a debit card and number will be required by everybody in the USA who wants to do business. It is also planned for every country in the world. Some people hold that the American Star War program was mostly concerned with satellites to deal with the automatic transfer of funds from all over the world to the super bank, the wholesaler in America. It is claimed that the prime banks in America remain as retailers and the central banks become retailers in foreign countries. In 1990, an article in Moody magazine claims that there is a gigantic computer three stories high located in an administration building of the Common Market in Brussels, a self-programming computer. According to the article, Dr. Alderman, chief analyst, points out that by using three entries of six digits each, every inhabitant of the world would be given a distinct credit card number. This number would be invisibly tattooed by laser, either on the forehead or on the back of the hand, walking credit card system, and the number could be seen only through infrared scanners installed in special verification counters or in business places. Of course, modern computerized credit cards for all would make it possible not only to monitor all individual financial transactions, but also to monitor individual physical locations and movements. So no one could buy or sell without first being given a numbered imprint, three entries of six digits, 666, the number of the beast of the apocalypse, instantaneous financial control of the whole world. Down the centuries, theologians and saints of the Catholic Church found it very difficult to explain how Antichrist could bring the world under his political and religious domination. Now we know. God's greatest punishment is chastisement in the reign of the Antichrist, for the scripture tells us what the Antichrist does, and it includes this. He compelled everybody, small and great, rich and poor, slave and citizens, to be branded on the right hand or on the forehead, and made it illegal for anyone to buy or sell anything unless he has been branded with the name of the beast or with the number. Apocalypse chapter 13, verse 16, 17. This then is the devil's plan to rule the whole world, and his people are almost ready to deliver it to him. The super capitalists who are in control of global high finance, with Zionism as their nationalism and communism as their bulldozer to clear off all other nationalisms, taking him to a high mountain, the devil showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. "I will give you all these," he said, "if you fall at my feet and worship me." Matthew chapter 4, verse 8 to 10. As Henor de Balzac once said, the final battle for Christianity will be over the money problem, and until that is solved, there can be no universal application of Christianity. The revolutionary change in the realm of high finance calls for a corresponding revolutionary change in the realm of politics, since a fully internationalized high finance cannot coexist in harmony with innumerable national concentrations of political power. The seizing of all wealth and political power on a global scale must also, of necessity, include control of all mankind through conditioning and manipulation of the mind and spirit of human beings. That is why, for many years, sensitivity training, for example, entered into society and did so much damage, especially to the young. A special advisory committee to the State Board of Education in California in May 1969 concluded sensitivity training is being used by those who are in fact aligned with revolutionary groups acting to contrary to public policy. That is, they intend to use the schools to destroy American culture and traditions. Dr. Edward Klotz, former special assistant to the board, and Professor Harden B. Jones of Berkeley, who made an extensive study of the Nazi use of sensitivity training in Hitler's Germany, were on that board. It goes back further to the Russian secret police and further to the Illuminati. In October 1945, a leftist Canadian psychiatrist, G. Chisholm, at the invitation of the communist Alger Hiss, gave three lectures in Washington, D.C., which laid the foundations for sex education and sensitivity training. He advocated doing away with the ways of the elders by force if need be, doing away with the concept of right and wrong, in accord with the Jewish Kabbalah, fumigate mom and dad psychologically with sensitivity training, and start sex education in the 4th, 5th, and 6th grades. When Chisholm was director of the World Health Organization, a member of his staff was Dr. Frank Calderone, husband of Mary Calderone of SECOS, the so-called Sex Information and Education Council of the United States, which was not an official organization, but a private enterprise that fooled many. Barbara Morris, in her booklet entitled "Why Are You Losing Your Children?", describes sensitivity training as a technique whereby a child is gradually made to shed all its parental teaching, its religious beliefs, and its individual leanings in favor of group or collective values. They probe deeply into the child's hang-ups, repressions, and fantasies, doctrinal beliefs, home difficulties, brought out for the morbid inspection of castmates, and it often results in traumas which the facilitator or educator is totally unqualified to control, according to Barbara Morris. This can be judged from their own material. Around the year 1976, in such a handbook used in the city of Southern Ireland, the teacher or facilitator is warned, this technique may create problems initially, will tend to disrupt the traditional authority-dependency relationship between teacher and pupil. It will be necessary to recognize anxiety and also to relieve group tension if it arises. At the start, the student may be unable to tolerate his newfound independence, and some may regress to almost primitive reactions. Early sessions may promote continuation of primitive-type behavior. Yet a few pages on, a Catholic coadjutor, Bishop, praises the program, congratulates the producers, and urges them to give this system a high priority. The system, indeed, as James Gibbs Stuart wrote, has an inbuilt capacity for attacking religion. The Chicago Tribune of January 26, 1969 stated as much, quote, "It, sensitivity training, can easily become, and often does, a form of group pressure and brainwashing that makes the subjects accept the lowest common denominator in morals, be vulnerable to anti-church and anti-family beliefs, destroys individuality, could lead to sexual promiscuity, creates neurotics and reduces people to vegetables, unable to do anything but accept the group orders," end quote. The Saturday Evening Post once claimed that about one half of the high schools in the States had some form of sensitivity training. It shows the power that lies behind it. The late Congressman Usher L. Burdick put it this way, "To bring this country into line to accept world government, many things must be done by the United Nations and her agencies such as UNESCO. First of all, love of country is found by these conspirators to be very deep and hard to destroy. Here, UNESCO comes into play to teach these children, specially trained teachers, that love of country interferes with loyalty to a world organization, and that they must transfer their loyalty to a world organization," end of quote. Dr. Dietrich von Hildebrand, professor emeritus at Fordham University, had this to say of Catholics who had introduced sensitivity training into the church and its schools. "Of them we must say either that they are so blind that they do not realize how they could thereby undermine the very foundation of Christian faith and true Christian life, or else, willingly or unwillingly, they are members of a conspiracy aiming to destroy the church from within. Let us not be fooled. Sensitivity training is a diabolical attack on man's nature and dignity, and especially on his vocation as a Catholic. It destroys dignity, spiritual freedom, veracity, and moral responsibility, and it thereby undermines our life as Christians, our relation to Christ, and the sanctification to which we are called." End of quote. September 1990, at the United Nations in New York, the World Summit on Children took place, with over 160 countries participating. It concluded with an international treaty, Charter of the Rights of the Child, which was signed by all UN member countries. Some of the articles of this charter are Article 2, parents are not to punish their child in any way for actions or words contrary to their beliefs or standards. Article 6, the government is to have the final say in everything concerning the child. Article 13, parents are not to place any restrictions on what a child sees, hears, or is taught or experiences in any way. Article 14, parents may not determine medical treatment for their children, nor may they refuse state-mandated treatment. Article 28, parents may not educate their children at home. The Canadian journal Michael, in its November-December 91 issue, published this under the heading, "The New Rights of the Child, the State Seizes Children." Obviously, it has planned to de-Christianize all children while leaving Christian parents powerless to defend their children. In the ruins of what was once Capernaum on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, there lies an enormous millstone. One wonders, was Jesus looking at it when he said, "But he that shall scandalize one of these little ones that believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone should be hanged about his neck and that he should be drowned in the depths of the sea." Matthew, Gospel 18, verse 6.